You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Let me welcome all of you to Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My name is Jim Collins. I am the director of the Russian and Eurasian program here at the Carnegie Endowment. And I am very pleased today to bring a discussion of what is certainly the overwhelmingly prominent and predominant issue that seems to be shaping both much of Russia's domestic evolution and development, but also the evolution and development of Russia's place in the outside world and the global system. And that is what's going on in the Russian response to and participation in the global economic crisis that is still very much the dominant subject in this town and much of the rest of the world. We are privileged today to have the author, or at least the lead coordinator and author for the World Bank's most recent study on the Russian economy and its outlook. Zeliko Bogatich is and has been for the last year or so the head of the Russian office of the World Bank, and he is economic policy team. I don't know the whole structure of World Bank matters, so I'll make you the head of the office for my purposes.
Thanks, but no thanks.
In any event, I know you are responsible largely for the report, and it is to that subject that we are going to turn here today. With him is my colleague, Uri Dadush, who was also, until recently, with the World Bank and has brought extraordinary expertise to the Carnegie Endowment as a new leader of our area, our expertise on international trade. He is an expert on international trade, and I think he is going to provide comment and discussion about the international context for which the Russian report sets the stage domestically in Russia. And so I'm not going to take any more time. I have the privilege at the end of this of making a few comments, which I will do perhaps on the my own observations of some of the implications for this. But I would like to turn the floor over now to Zeliko and ask him for his presentation, and then Uri Dadush will follow with some comments and observations on the international setting. So, Zeliko, please.
Thank you very, very much to be here. It's a pleasure to be here and share my thoughts about Russia's evolving economic crisis with this distinguished audience and the panel consisting of my dear colleague, former colleague, Dr. Dadush, and the Ambassador Collins. And I have to say in this forum that I still consider myself a student of the Russian economy. And I know that many of you have studied Russian economy for many, many more years than I have. So please consider this as a perspective by an economist on some of the latest developments that we observed in Russia in the context of the global financial crisis. And I'm very, very much interested in your questions and criticisms and discussions that we would have following the presentation. I'd like to focus on four main topics. The first, what Yuri has termed a global storm, or the global storm, and I will go over this part fairly telegraphically because I know that Uri has a lot to say about this, and then focus much more on Russia's storm, and that is Russia's economic developments. since last August, September, about a time when Russia experienced the first major impact of the crisis. Then I will talk a little bit about the policy response, focusing specifically on fiscal policy as the main instrument of managing the crisis in Russia and in other countries. And finally, speculate a little bit about what more can be done in the current environment of high uncertainty and a crisis deepening and moving from the financial sector, real economy, into the social sectors. I think it's clear now that any way you look at it, when you look at the high-frequency data at the global level, it's the worst global crisis since the Second World War. If that wasn't clear a few months ago, that is now crystal clear. It's a deep, it's a synchronized, and it's a global crisis, which includes a financial crisis. And all of these dimensions are significant for understanding the depth, the structure, and duration and the likely recovery of this particular crisis. As you see on this graph, basically starting about October, November, the industrial production around the world fell off the cliff. In high-income countries and developing countries, and Russia here looks very much like a high-income countries with deep double-digit declines in industrial production. It is synchronized crisis across countries and across all components of demand, consumption, investment, and exports. So everything is falling, largely at double-digit levels. The crisis is combined with the deep financial crisis, which makes it probably more prolonged and more difficult to get out of, as some of the recent research, including by our colleagues from the IMF, shows. Without going into the details of the complex and the murky territory of the causes of this crisis, and we could perhaps discuss some of that in the Q&A, here is a glimpse of the current official World Bank's global economic outlook for the world economy for this year and next. And the outlook is very grim. We see for the first time after the Second World War, we see a decline in real output of about 1.7% and the decline in world trade of about 6.1%. So it's a simultaneous recession, if you like, output and trade, something we haven't seen in a long time. WTO recently came up even with a more pessimistic figure on trade, minus 9%. But any way you look at it, and any of these high-frequency data you look at, GDP, industrial production, trade data, it is grim across the board, across the countries, and across components of demand. There is a possibility that this all will end sometime at the end of this year and early next year, and that there will be a bounce back. But it's highly uncertain. So anything I have to say about 2010, take with a great grain of salt, and it's really a little more than a guesswork, educated guess, and fully contingent on the outcome of 2009. In this depressed environment, the oil prices are likely to remain fairly low. That is in the $40-$50 range. Here we're talking about the index of the World Bank's three main oils, Brent, Dubai, and WTI. The Urals price of oil, which is more relevant for Russia, typically has a bit of a discount because of its heavy oil nature. And here we see that price averaging about $45 this year and $45 to $48 next year, depending on the movements of this discount. So that's the global context that has dramatically changed in a matter of just a couple of months, and which, by the way, has taken by surprise many analysts, including myself, certainly in terms of the strength of the downturn. Capital flows to developing countries are drying out. They're coming down from the level of about almost $1 trillion in 2007 to probably no more than $165 billion this year, essentially almost equivalent of a classic global sudden stop, if you like. And here in the bottom panel, you see the World Bank's forecast for the price of oil that I talked about. If you talk to oil market and energy specialists, they will tell you that they are more comfortable about telling you where the oil price should be and is likely to be a couple of years from now rather than what's going to happen with the oil price tomorrow. I think that it's fairly clear that the long-term marginal cost of production of oil is going up. So there is a consensus that the oil should be somewhere around $75 a barrel when this is all over. Meanwhile, however, the oil market is driven very much by the depressed U.S. And the world economy, and perhaps some movements on the OPEC front. Russia enters the storm around September last year, hit by a triple whammy, triple and major shock. First, apparently, is the decline in the price of oil from $140 per barrel to about $40. All happening in a matter of few months. This is a far bigger oil shock than the one that Russia experienced in 97, 98. Second, the capital flow, a massive sudden stop and then a reversal in capital flows to Russia, which experienced a record inflow, net inflow of about $80 billion in 2007, and then an outflow of about $130 billion last year, almost all concentrated in the last quarter of 2008. So the total impact is equivalent to about $210 billion in relation to about $1.3, $1.5 trillion economy. So any way you cut it, these are massive shocks and all happening at the same time in a matter of months. Finally, the financing dried up, a sharp drop in access to finance, and the terms in, as reflected in very high spreads, both sovereign and corporate and banking spreads. Something that is particularly relevant for the transmission of the crisis in Russia and the outcome. Well, as a result, the first thing that collapsed in Russia was the stock market, obviously, together with the oil price. Oil price and stock market tend to move in Russia in unison, in almost perfect correlation, especially on the downside. You could almost see that perfect correlation on a chart starting July of last year. The initial impact was concentrated in the stock market, and the loss of the capitalization was massive, almost $1 trillion in a matter of a few months. But it was largely concentrated again in the oil and gas sector, because that's where the biggest share of oil of the Russia stock market is concentrated. High net worth individuals in Russia, you've read in newspapers, have lost anywhere between $250 and $300 billion. So there was also a wealth effect affecting households, although that wealth effect was a much more skewed and concentrated in Russia than, for example, in the United States. Then the financial sector liquidity crunch came on the eve of the Lehman Brothers collapse around the world, including Russia, and that was a big wake-up call to policymakers that this is very different and that it may require a strong and rapid policy response, and we'll come back to that later. But basically, if you compare the 2008 data and the early numbers in January and February, you see basically a shift of an economy growing at about 8%, clearly overheating, real wages outpacing productivity growth in double digits, full employment, capital utilization at the maximum or even above, and all of this essentially melting away in a matter of months, and industrial production falling in January 16%, in February 13%. These are year-on-year numbers. Capital investment minus 15%. And so on and so forth. So all of the initially strong macro fundamentals, if you like, the twin surpluses, the strong growth began melting very, very rapidly. If you look at the demand side of Russia's growth, you see clearly that investment was the first to collapse, obviously hurt by the sharp financing constraint and the uncertainty associated with the internal and external crisis. But consumption was also hit hard, this was associated essentially by the rapid rise, perhaps unexpectedly rapid rise in unemployment. To remind you, Russian households depend very much on wages and salaries. Russian households don't own houses, don't own large financial saving balances, so they basically depend for their sustenance on wages and salaries. So a rise in unemployment in Russia means a direct hit on the household income and therefore consumption. This is what we see here. In this environment, the net exports obviously cannot act as a engine or even a cushion to growth, given the collapse of external demand in the neighborhood and the global economy. If we look at the supply side of growth, sectoral side, we see essentially across-the-board slowdown at the end of 2008 and then a deep recession in 2009. Both tradables and non-tradable sectors hit hard. Dramatic drops in early 2009, particularly construction, transport, all in high double digits. Retail trade, which typically is a big sector, obviously, and there is some lag there, but even retail trade is now taking a hit, and manufacturing, the past engine of Russia's industrial growth, has obviously taken a huge hit, and you've heard about the auto industry problems in Russia that are not that dissimilar from the problems in other developed countries. Why was the impact on Russia so strong? Huge topic, we could discuss this, but very briefly, these factors played a role. Dependence on oil, gas, and metals, the prices of which all collapsed in a matter of months, as I discussed, capital inflows, and short-term external borrowing by banks and enterprises. In fact, many of the banks in Russia, smaller and medium-sized banks, almost built their development, I mean, their business model around the external short-term borrowing and easy money that the global economy provided in the years to run up to the crisis. And this essentially, when this disintegrated, their business model collapsed. Small SME sector in Russia. This is a big missing middle and the missing base of Russia's business environment that could potentially serve as a cushion and serve the non-traded internal economy. Was largely still a very much underdeveloped, and this is a problem. This has increased the vulnerability of the Russian economy to this crisis. Narrow economic structure, low value added, still largely a pipeline economy. Low competitiveness and, as I mentioned at the beginning, unexpectedly deep drop in the world demand. Labor markets in Russia started adjusting very rapidly, and this is an interesting feature of the crisis in Russia, that labor markets in Russia now are probably much more flexible than perhaps ever before. So employment is adjusting downwards in both private sectors and public sector. The country went from a full employment situation in September to about 8.5% unemployment in February, using ILO definition. If you use the local definition, it is much lower, but the correct figure is probably somewhere between the two and probably closer to the ILO definition. And even that, I think, underestimates the size of the employment impact because there is massive conversion from full employment to part-time employment going on as well. On top of that, you had the wage arrears growing, although from a zero base. The stock of those arrears now amount to about equivalent of about $240 million. Affecting about 1% of the labor force. This is not large, and clearly we're not seeing the return to barterization of 98, but is happening. And in some sectors and some regions, it could be it could be large in the months to come. On this chart, you can see how tradable and non-tradable sectors began rapidly shedding employment in response to the output downturn. Output line is the green line, and you can see how the tradables were the first hit, but then the non-tradables, as the unemployment situation began to worsen, the non-tradables took a big hit, and now essentially all components of domestic demand are fairly depressed. Balance of payments situation has also dramatically melted compared to the pre-crisis situation. Current account balance for last year was still healthy, about $100 billion, but in the last quarter alone of 2008, it was only $8 billion. Gives you a sense of the scale of the terms of trade shock and the impact on exports and imports. On the capital account side, as I mentioned, there was this massive capital flow turnaround from plus 82 to minus 130 billion, and this is expected to continue this year. On the in the financial sector, obviously, apart from the proverbial liquidity and capital shortage problems, the underlying problem specific to Russia and many other Eastern European countries is that the Russian banks were relying excessively on foreign borrowing as a model for its for funding its domestic operations, and that is a problem. You can see here the evolution of the loan to deposit ratio. When this ratio is about 100, that's healthy. That means that the it's a traditional bank that finances its operation from deposits, as mostly should be. When this ratio goes up too high, that means the banks are using all sorts of non-traditional sources of financing, including external borrowing. So this is the average for the country as a whole. Some of these banks, had these ratios 200-300%, essentially largely relying on the external funding. And when that stopped, essentially their business model collapsed. This is part of the problem that we've seen in the financial sector during the crisis. On the monetary exchange and the fiscal policy front, very, very quickly, monetary exchange policy initially was aiming to support the liquidity and to alleviate the liquidity crunch in September and October, and they did the usual thing that most countries did in that environment. They dropped the reserve requirements, dropped the interest rates, trying to ease the liquidity any way possible. But afterwards, obviously, as the loss of international reserves accelerated in the context of the quasi-fixed exchange rate, the central bank began shifting the policy and opened up the corridor of the ruble and started tightening, actually, the monetary conditions in order to preserve reserves and support the ruble, which has been relatively stable in the past couple of months, in line with the stability at a low level of oil prices. I should mention that oil price is a fundamental variable for Russia's ruble, and understanding the broad movements in Russia and pressures on ruble requires, I think, the understanding of the underlying movements of the oil price. To some extent, one can argue that Russia's ruble is a commodity currency, just like South African rand or Canadian dollar, reflecting the upward and downward pressures on the currency in line with the upward and downward pressures in the underlying key export commodity. On the fiscal policy side, fiscal policy has, from the outset, attempted to cushion the impact on the real economy and the population. And the fiscal situation has dramatically deteriorated from about plus 4% of GDP federal fiscal surplus last year to the likely minus 7.4 fiscal balance this year, maybe more. Huge deterioration, obviously. And most of this fiscal support and the fiscal stimulus, if you like, that I'll talk about in a second, was actually directed towards banks and enterprises. This is a very broad telegraphic picture about what we've seen in Russia, what we've seen in Russia in the global context, and in terms of the latest macro developments. So we now have about 2-3 months data for this year, and we try to speculate about what's the outlook for the rest of the year. This is what we see. Given the global outlook that I described, given the oil price outlook, we see Russia's real GDP declining by 4.5% this year. This is a massive turnaround from plus 5.6% last year and over 8% over the first 3 months of last year. Federal fiscal balance swinging from, as I said, plus 4 to minus 8% almost of GDP. Current account melting from over 100, about 100 down to about 30 billion. But not really because of good export performance, but really because of the collapse of imports, while net capital outflows would continue and possibly could reach 170 billion. This may be a bit of a conservative assumption, but we already note that 35 billion has already left this year, and there are significant repayment, short-term repayment obligations by Russia's banks and enterprises. So this is our best guess, if you like, about what's going to happen, what's going to be the macro environment in Russia this year. 2010, at best, we see a zero growth or a very, very modest recovery towards the latter part of 2010, in line with the weak and prolonged recovery of the global economy and low oil prices. But I have to say, honestly, that 2010 is a little more than our educated guess, fully conditional upon what's going to happen in 2009. The big unknown is the behavior and the turnaround of the U.S. economy. But certainly our team, and I think probably the consensus of most analysts, is that this crisis is going to be more prolonged than initially thought. And this is what we're looking at for Russia. Just to put a bit of a historical perspective on this crisis, if you look at 2008-9 crisis and compare it with 1998 crisis, two points to consider. First, it is now clear that this crisis is going to be deeper and longer than 98 crisis in terms of the deceleration of growth, not in terms of the negative growth, the initial impact in 98, which was deeper, obviously, the first two quarters. But if you recall, in 98, there was really kind of a V-shaped pattern of real GDP movement, deep decline in real GDP, but then a rapid recovery of, led by net exports in what was then relatively benign international environment. While this time around, we basically see the harshest international economic environment since the Second World War, and the dynamics more conspiring towards an L-shaped, if you like, recovery rather than a V-shaped recovery. When we look at the major components of demand, such as investment and exports, we get more or less the same picture. In terms of the nature of 98 crisis and 2008 crisis, they're also different. I would call them fraternal twins because, again, oil was partly the father of both crises. But that's where most similarities end. So these are non-identical twins. The 98 crisis was, by and large, actually public sector and fiscal crisis and the currency crisis that ended up in a debt default and sharp devaluation and then a rapid V-shaped recovery. By contrast, the 2008 crisis was more of a private sector crisis, as we know, in the rest of the country, in the context of very, very strong macro and fiscal fundamentals and large international and fiscal reserves that Russia had before the crisis. The problem was, obviously, that the international demand collapsed for Russia's both traditional oil, gas and metals and non-traditional exports, and its sources of liquidity and financing essentially stopped far more abruptly and are likely to remain depressed for a longer period of time. A lot more could be said about the comparison of these two crises, but those are the two things that I want to leave you with. It's going to be longer and deeper, and that this is a private sector as opposed to public sector crisis. While the public sector is now providing a certain amount of cushion to the economy. What was the Russia's policy response? We could talk a lot about the overall policy response in terms of the monetary policy, quasi-fiscal, fiscal, but here I'd like to focus on the fiscal policy side proper, because this is emerging as the main instrument of government's actions to cushion the impact of the crisis on the economy and the people. Because in this environment of financial sector problems, the monetary policy is far less effective in addressing the underlying problems. What was the size of fiscal support that Russia extended since September 2008 and announced for this year? Well, to the best of our knowledge, and we did a bit of bean counting here, to the best we can, and trying to distinguish between the announcements and action and fiction and reality and also some overlapping measures, it looks like it's about 6.7% of GDP. This is large. And it was probably justifiable in terms of the fact that Russia experienced far greater deceleration of growth than many other G20 countries. The other element in this kind of a calculation of whether to provide fiscal support to the economy in these circumstances was the fact that Russia's automatic stabilizers, as we call them in macroeconomics, are far weaker than those in Western European countries. And the size of government actually is actually smaller. So if you like, the cushion to the economy is much, much weaker. Therefore, there might be a case for a fiscal response, kind of a Keynesian fiscal response in these circumstances. And certainly if the country, as it did, had substantial fiscal reserves to spend, which, by the way, were precisely built up to deal with these kinds of, perhaps not as bad, but these kinds of eventualities. So the total support was about 6.7% of GDP, and bulk of that went to the financial sector in the initial part of the crisis, about 3.3%, then real economy, and interestingly, very little for social protection that was directed towards the households. When we break down the support to the financial system, we see that most of that went for liquidity support in the early months of the crisis in the form of subordinated loans, but also for recapitalization and for the mortgage housing and deposit guarantee agency and recapitalization of some of the major banks. And then as the country and the crisis began moving from the financial sector to the real economy, the policy response also moved in that direction, providing direct support, fiscal support to specific strategic sectors, industries, and firms. This support amounted to about 3.4% of GDP. Bulk of it went to enterprises, and again, very little to households and to regions. Some features of the fiscal support to enterprises was that there was a large emphasis on tax reduction. And this is a little bit where Russia's fiscal response was different from that in other countries. About half of that was in the form of various tax breaks and tax reductions. The second one was limited infrastructure spending, limited support to SMEs, limited interventions in the labor market, and the potential support to strategic enterprises. How does Russia's fiscal stimulus compare with G20 countries? On the left-hand panel, you can see the estimated size of this fiscal stimulus in G20 countries, and you can see that Russia is among those countries that had a fairly large stimulus, not as large as in the United States and China, but still fairly large, as I mentioned. And on the right-hand panel, you can see that Russia is a bit of an outlier in terms of the growth deceleration, the vertical axis, and this fiscal stimulus, the horizontal axis. I note that Russia's fiscal stimulus is larger than the internationally recommended 2% of GDP for countries that have fiscal space to try to affect the domestic demand. Meanwhile, while all of this was happening, while the banks were under pressure and getting a lot of financial support and enterprises were crying for help and some getting support in conditional or unconditional form, there was another silent tsunami developing, and that is the social impact. And it was spreading very, very fast. As I mentioned, unemployment shot up from full employment to 8.5%. This is where we have the sectoral picture of employment losses. This is actually a simulation of what we believe is a likely outcome by the end of 2009, where manufacturing, construction, and retail are going to be particularly hard hit as the employment effect continues to unfold. Related to that, closely related to the unemployment escalation, is the increase in poverty, because as I mentioned, Russia's household depend on wages and salaries for their well-being, and so rising unemployment immediately translates into households falling below the official poverty line, which is how we calculated this impact here. And basically what you see is that 1.1 million households have already gone down into poverty last year, and probably another 4.7 million might go into poverty this year without additional measures that could perhaps provide either income or employment support to these people. Who are the poor? Well, We know who the poor are. We've done a fairly extensive analysis of Russia's poverty, and they tend to be low-income families with children, with large number of children. They tend to be unemployed and the low-end pensioners. So these are the three, and obviously some of the rural households. So these are the most vulnerable groups to this kind of downturn. So the question in this environment arises, given that the crisis has actually moved from the initial impact, or kind of almost a fire type impact on the financial sector and the real economy, to the social impact rapidly unfolding in, right now, the question arises: what more can or should be done by policymakers in Russia in this environment? It seems to us that that given the scale of this social impact, it might be prudent to use the remaining fiscal space this year to target more households rather than banks and enterprises to cushion this social impact. And I think this might be a prudent policy, not just from the social perspective, but from the macroeconomic perspective also, because these are, these poorer households tend to be also people who have higher propensity to consume, who are not going to spend this additional stimulus on expensive imported goods or exchange it for dollars and or send it overseas to a bank account in Cyprus or Switzerland. So this is going to be spent on local non-traded Russian goods, providing some cushion to domestic demand at a time of collapsing consumption. So from the point of view of social protection and macro policy, this would make sense in this environment. And then we thought about what could be the structure of such a package. How large and what kind of instruments would we use? Certain criteria are that it would have to be affordable. It can't break the remaining piggy bank and cause inflation. It should be cost-efficient in alleviating poverty. It should be scalable. And it should use the existing social safety net instruments in order to be quick. There is no time in this environment to invent completely new instruments of support. So you have to work with what you have. Clearly, the social safety net in Russia leaves a lot to be desired. There are a lot of leakages. There are a lot of parts that don't really benefit poor, that benefit the middle class and, or even rich households. But there are some instruments that can be used for this purpose. And we have concluded that there are three instruments matching precisely those most vulnerable groups. That's the unemployment benefits, that's the child allowance, and that's the low-end pensions, precisely targeting the most vulnerable groups. And then we try to simulate a package that is constructed so to maximize the poverty reduction for a given budget. And we have concluded that a package worth of about 1% of GDP, equivalent to about $13-15 billion, broken down into these three programs, temporary scaling up of these three programs for 12 months, for the next 12 months, which we believe is, are going to be the most critical from the social point of view, would have a very significant impact and help as much as 4 million people out of those 4.7 to perhaps just keep their head above the water in terms of escaping poverty compared with a no-program scenario. So as I said, far from being ideal instruments, this is the best that can be done if you want to, if your objective is to alleviate the poverty impact in Russia today. What more? In sum, we think that in this environment it might be prudent to focus on two fronts. One, in the short term, put in place something similar to this kind of social protection package. And two, also prepare for the recovery stage, because in the recovery stage it will be very important that some of the most difficult infrastructure bottlenecks are addressed, because we know from experience that when the economy is exiting the deep crisis, infrastructure bottlenecks can very quickly become binding constraint and they can choke off the nascent growth. So it's important to address some of these constraints. And they are typically, they're well known. They're located in some of the biggest centers of economic activity in Russia. You know, there are many of them in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, in Urals. And with limited spending, well-targeted, I think this could be a good investment in the recovery stage. Small and medium-sized enterprises have obviously been hit hard. Russia needs to invest in this sector, both from the perhaps through some innovative microfinance and other kinds of instruments raising access, but even more so by reducing barriers to entry and exit and the regulatory burden on the small and medium-sized enterprises. So this would be the kind of a proposed two-pronged front of actions that would make sense in our view in Russia today. What more? Well, accelerating structural reforms. I know this sounds like a litany of things and another way of saying that everything is important, but indeed Russia has done a lot, but a lot remains to be done. There's huge structural reform agenda ahead. Some is being forced upon the authorities, such as the banking sector consolidation and modernization. This might go ahead at a faster pace now simply because the financing constraint is so strong that it's going to take place. The others will require leadership and sustained effort for these reforms to materialize. They include public administration, governance, reform, fighting corruption, improving investment climate, infrastructure regulation, WTO agenda. Russia is the largest country outside the WTO system. WTO, I think, is important, and Uri will correct me if I'm wrong here, not just because, and perhaps not even mostly because of the reductions in further reductions in tariffs and the trade effects perhaps that Russia might get at this point, but more in terms of actually locking in a trade institutional environment in Russia that will hopefully have a beneficial long-term impact on Russia's trade investment and competitiveness and growth long-term. And finally, the improving the effectiveness and targeting of the social safety net, and this clearly can't happen over time, but is absolutely needed. Final word. There are downside risks to the world economy and for Russia. In my mind, they stem from three specific types of risks. The first is social impact and the associated social tensions that can arise in Russia, especially in the most vulnerable regions. And we can talk about what they may be in the Q&A. But this is a real risk, that if some sort of social cushion is not put in place of the kind that we discussed, this can escalate. Second is the second-round effect on the financial sector. This is the same that's happening all over the world. In Russia, it's real. The Minister of Finance has warned that this is the next tsunami coming, and the big question is how it's going to be managed. The third is the prolonged possibility of a depression of global demand, and this is something that I've heard from several analysts of the global economy, including Uri. And I was slow to catch up on this possibility, I must say. Now I think that this is a non-marginal risk. Taken together, these three risks can conspire to create a much more difficult policy environment for the world and for Russia. Therefore, policy must remain vigilant, flexible, and ready to respond quickly to changing and deteriorating circumstances. And in the downside scenario, perhaps well-designed and implemented more aggressive labor market programs might be needed to further alleviate the impact of the crisis. And a very final thought that I don't have a question, I don't have any answer to, but would very much like to hear perspectives on by our panelists. What is the nature of this crisis? I think the analysts and the policymakers and the politicians are still struggling with that. There is clearly a cyclical component, a collapse in demand that at some point is going to reestablish equilibrium between demand and supply at a lower level of prices and when inventories are depleted and the investments will start to grow again. But there are clearly sectors, whole swaths of sectors of the economies in the world and in Russia that may not be competitive or even sustainable in medium and long term, and that will have to either scale down significantly and or restructure. And the sooner that takes place, probably the better for the for the health of the economy and for competitiveness in the post-crisis period, which is going to be much tougher, much more competitive, and much more constrained in terms of liquidity and funding than before the crisis. So what's the balance between the cyclical and the structural components is something that is very important for policymakers to get a handle on, because depending on that answer, the policy response will have to be geared in one or another or another direction. Thank you very much.
I know how to put this next presentation on. Somebody can help? Let me, while they try to figure that out, let me say first that I was just in Russia, and I met with several economists there who explained to me. It's fine. And over a couple of days that I was there, and I hadn't met Zeliko before, and as I said to him at the time, the encounter with him was for me by far the most educational, even though I had very, very good meetings, and the most comprehensive, and I think you've seen that in today's presentation, and that's why I was so keen that he be with us today as he comes here for the spring meetings. I'm really going to add a little bit of international perspective, elaborate on some of his points, hopefully quite quickly. I'm going to make four main points. The first is that Russia is among the worst hit countries. The second is, although the most recent forecasts are calling for a global recovery in 2010, worse scenarios are possible. Zeliko alluded to this. The third point is markets are rallying, or did rally until yesterday. I have to change my tune every day with the markets. But the sustainability is suspect. I wrote this last Friday, by the way. The sustainability of the rally is suspect. And the fourth point is that it is indeed difficult times ahead for Russia and for many other vulnerable countries. And policy now, perhaps it's a hackneyed phrase or a cliche, but policy now needs to do more rather than do less. These are my main points. This chart shows you that Russia is among the worst hit countries if you look at financial indicators. So we have a ranking that we have developed of countries based on exchange rate devaluation, sovereign spread deterioration, and stock markets. These are variables that you can know about every moment, practically. You can rank all countries of the world of how they fared over the last 6 months, and Russia is right there among the worst. Even though their bond spreads have not deteriorated as much as the worst hit countries, Ukraine, Hungary, Greece, and Austria that are here, their currency devaluation has been among the largest, and their equity market collapse has been among the largest. The forecast for Russia is 5% decline in GDP, a little more, plus or minus. That's a lot worse than the average for developing countries. Very few developing countries have that kind of decline. By the way, just as an irony, the least affected country is the United States in terms of these indicators. So I'd like to extend my congratulations to my American friends for engineering the crisis and then being the least affected of all countries of the world. It's a very good question why Russia is the most affected. And it really is... a difficult question, because Russia, you know, is an investment-grade country. It has moderate political risk, according to the indicators. It has very low public debt. It started off with huge reserves as a share of imports. And when you come down to it, oil and metal dependence by itself, I don't think explains the fact that they are so badly affected. Many other countries are oil dependent and are somewhat less affected. And my conclusion from looking at what's been happening is you really have a couple of complicating elements in Russia. One is very important, one somewhat less important. The very important one is that this is a country whose banking and private sector is fully integrated now into the global system and has borrowed very heavily in foreign currency. So you have the combination of the commodity price shock and the banking fragilities. And this is a question mark in my mind. I'm not sure that the response to the crisis by the authorities was optimal in terms of trying to defend the currency for so long, letting reserves come down, etc. Russia also stands out as a country that has relatively high inflation. Still, double-digit inflation. Very few of these developing countries have high inflation. Again, that undermines confidence. So, yes, the commodity price shock, very important. But overlay on that, the private sector borrowing and the banking fragilities, and that helps explain the truly violent effect of the crisis on Russia. This is the global forecast. All I want to say here, I cobbled this together from the most recent reputable sources. All I want to say here really is that even under this baseline, Russia is going to have a very hard time because the baseline forecast has a recovery in 2010, but it's a very modest recovery. World trade grows 1.5% in 2010, having fallen 12% in 2009. This is the OECD number. Every number that comes out on world trade, I'm thinking about the IMF, World Bank, WTO, and OECD, which have come out in sequence, has lowered the forecast for world trade for 2009. And now we're looking at a precipitous decline of world trade, 12%. But even in 2010, it's a very modest number. And the capital flows, very, very difficult to say. But oil prices, even under the recovery forecast, are staying in the vicinity of $50. And $50 just means very large pressures on Russia, continued very large pressures on Russia. And the International Energy Agency just came out with their new numbers, and their predicted fall in demand in 2009 is now over 2 billion barrels, not 1 billion barrels. 2 million barrels, not 1 million barrels a day. Stocks are very high, and OPEC discipline is working, but not perfectly. So all of these factors are already pointing to a bad scene, but what I do want to say is that this modest recovery in 2010 is by no means in the bag at all. And we could be seeing things quite a lot worse than that. Let me say a word about the markets. You've had a 20% rally in the stock markets in the industrial countries in the last 5-6 weeks. You had a 35% rally in emerging markets. You've had about 100% decline in the spread on emerging market bonds. You know, truly a change in sentiments in the market, at least up until Monday. And what is it based on? It's based on some leading indicators and coincident indicators that are pointing to a turning point. Here you see one of the more reliable ones. This is the Purchasing Managers Index. These are surveys of purchasing managers. They have been historically very reliable in predicting turning points, and you ask purchasing managers whether they see an increase in activity or not. And when you have a figure under 50, that means that most purchasing managers are predicting a decline in activity. And what you see from the chart is there's been a pickup in the Purchasing Managers Index, meaning not that they are anticipating an increase of activity, but that they are seeing a smaller decrease in activity than they saw before. And this, of course, is technically a necessary first step to a recovery, but is interpreted by the markets as being precisely that. And here you see some more convincing evidence. This is the frightening chart. You see it around in a lot of different places now. This comes from my former colleagues at the World Bank. It shows you the industrial production index for the world going back to 1990. It shows the collapse of industrial production in the course of the last 6 months. This is a month-over-month annualized, a month-over-month growth rate. And what you see just in the last couple of months, you see this pickup. This pickup means that we are going from industrial production falling at 3.5% to 4% every month. Every month, 3.5%, 4%. Okay, these are normally changes we see in a year. Okay, and now we are seeing industrial production falling at a little under 3%. Okay, that's the good news. And that is what is prompting the markets more than anything else to rally. Now, warning. So far, the decline in industrial production is worse than we had during the Great Depression. So if you go back to 1929 and June 1929, and you go back to April 2008, and you look at how industrial production has fared during these two shocks, basically we are a little worse than during the Great Depression. But the reason I'm showing this chart is not just to make that point. It's also to show that even during the 4 years, the 40 months or so, during which global economic activity collapsed, world GDP fell by about 30% during the Great Depression, even during that period, you had several instances where the index of industrial production not only slowed its descent, which is what we're observing at the moment, but actually came back up. And you can see steps in that function. And, of course, those recoveries were short-lived. And it was only about 3.5 or 4 years into the Depression that we had the big turnaround. An even worse picture, unfortunately, emerges for world trade. The world trade decline that we're witnessing is truly historic, significantly worse than happened in the first year of the Great Depression. These charts come from Aichen Green and O'Rourke in a paper that was just published on a website called Vox EU. Okay, now, why is it difficult and protracted? What is the dynamic here helps explain this? I think a useful way to think about what is happening is the interaction between the momentum of economic activity and balance sheets. Basically, you have falling economic activity that has repercussions on balance sheets that deteriorate, and that in turn has repercussions on economic activity. This is, in a way, the essence of financial crisis. And that interaction can become a vicious circle or can become a virtuous circle if policy does things right, whatever happens, that helps. But because you have that vicious circle characteristic, financial crises are known to last, have been shown to last 2 to 3 times longer than ordinary recessions, and the decline in output can be 2 to 10 times bigger than ordinary recessions. And the point is that it's all balance sheets that are being affected. It's Harvard University's balance sheet, but it is also the balance sheets of households where the wealth has been a decline, has been estimated to be over 100% of GDP. It is banks where the IMF has estimated that losses from U.S.-based assets are in excess of $2 trillion. Today, I think they've published a new estimate, which is $2.7 trillion, and worldwide, the balance sheet loss on the banks is $4 trillion. Remember that the total capital of U.S. banks at the beginning of the crisis was about $1.3 trillion. So the average bank in the United States is bankrupt, according to the if there is such a thing as an average bank, according to these calculations. And now, of course, and this is one of the risks for Russia, is these private hits on balance sheets very quickly become public hits on balance sheets because it has been shown, again, research has shown, that during these financial crises, the deterioration in public debt to GDP ratios are typically in the region of 70%. And in fact, this is what we are observing. I mean, if you look at the IMF projections for a lot of the debt to GDP ratios, you will see that in the industrial countries, including in the United States, they are increasing by 20, 25%, 30% of GDP. So if you're not careful and you don't deal with things properly, then very quickly it isn't just the private sector that is bankrupt. It is the public sector that is bankrupt. We who have worked at the World Bank or at the IMF are very used to this phenomenon because we have seen it many times in emerging markets. But there is no law that this cannot happen, and indeed it has happened, in high-income countries in the past in selected cases. This is the very negative dynamic we're in. And that is why it is very important for policy to remain activist and to remain activist in an intelligent way. And in a way, and this is one of the things, one of the virtues of Zeliko's presentation, that brings out the social aspect. Because what policymakers are having to deal with at the moment is not just the redressing of the banking system and the fixing of the household finances through, you know, their operations in mortgage markets and so on and so forth. They also have to ensure that the social consensus that underpins these policies remains. And in the case of Russia, this is clearly one of the risks, but it isn't just in Russia. It's in many other countries. And that's why the social aspect of the crisis needs attention. I think I'll stop there. Thank
you. Well, I'm only going to make a couple of observations that I think in some ways are perhaps the obvious, but I think nevertheless always need to be kept in mind and put forefront as we think about what is evolving as the Russian system and where American interests may find themselves challenged because of it. I think the first point I'd make is that if we look at the system and the structure or the paradigm, perhaps we could call it, that existed as Russia moved into its new political structure of an elected president and a president who stepped down to become prime minister, and this sort of unusual diarchy that has been running the country over the last year. The calculus which produced it was all essentially $140 a barrel oil, and an economy that was growing at, as I think Uri mentioned, perhaps an overheated rate, but was very successful, basically, for the average citizen, who could, in fact, say that I live better today than I did a year ago in the time of the new election and of a new president. What's happening, however, now is that that paradigm is under tremendous stress. And it is under great stress in almost all of its aspects that, in some sense, were underneath the Putin success. If we look at Putin's agenda, when he came into office, he said it was three things, and he more or less delivered. It was economic recovery and, to a degree, modernization. It was restoring the authority of the government and the state, and it was restoring Russia's international position. And as he left office, he probably was feeling reasonably comfortable that he had done a great deal to achieve and succeed in that agenda. Well, how quickly the world changes and how difficult the Russians would say they find maintaining that in these circumstances at the present time. And I think the real issue in some ways is what now is going to happen to the agenda that was in some ways articulated by Putin's successor of modernizing Russia's economy, continuing the recovery of its international position and making it more influential, and in many ways continuing to have a highly centralized governmental system. I would submit that it seems that all of these are now under great challenge, and you are watching a President Medvedev decide that he has to do more to engage the public because of it. And the question is, where is it going? And here I would say there are some things to watch. One is the relationship between central and regional and municipal government, which was described by Mr. Putin as the vertical of power, which is now under great stress and great challenge, it seems to me. Because the vertical of power, in some sense, depended on the top of the pyramid being able to pay the bottom. And that is now under great question. And when that comes under question, the issue of the relationships between these levels of government and the citizens they serve and the groups they serve is up for change. The second thing, it seems to me, that now is under great question is how Russia will, in fact, address this new modernization agenda. Most of it is being deferred. The money is clearly not there in the way it was. So issues of modernizing its infrastructure, making the investments in the human infrastructure side, education, science, technology, health, are clearly at risk. And making Russia basically more competitive is going to be that much more difficult, as some have here already suggested. That means that Russia's international position, as well as its domestic issues, it seems to me, is in at this point probably looking a good deal more problematic if you sit in Moscow and look out. You're still the country with the third largest global reserves. You still are, in some sense, a government in ways better off. But if the predictions or the prospects that are described in this report are accurate, none of that can be taken for granted as enduring or getting them necessarily beyond perhaps the end of this year or into next year. And so will Russia become, again, a debtor country? Will it become more and more vulnerable to international economic forces beyond its control, and how they will adjust to that is going to be a major, major issue, which they are barely beginning to understand or cope with. And I guess the final point I'd make is that in some sense, as always, there are certain opportunities for the Russian side in this. There is an opportunity for them to join in being a player that they could not be before in the international economic and financial institution building that presumably is coming as the world works its way out of this system. They have certainly an opportunity to take the next set of steps that will perhaps do better at structuring their own economic system, their own international relationships in the economic and financial world much better than they have in the past because of the forces that are going to affect everybody. This is an opportunity. There's no guarantee that that will be taken up. But finally, it seems to me that the critical issue for them is that if you combine the challenges they have with their population decline, the economic dependence on commodities and so forth, this is a moment at which some basic decisions will have to be made in a very difficult environment. And one hopes that the Russian establishment and the Russian leadership is going to be able to address those issues effectively. It seems to me it's in the American and the international interest that they do so. But there are no guarantees that they are prepared or necessarily going to address them effectively. I think the only optimism I bring to it is that in some ways, and I was talking to Angelico about this, the one group that seems to be emerging as key and as, in some sense, the acknowledged authority at the moment in dealing with this crisis are the people with what we would probably consider the better instincts. They are the ones who think you have to work as part of the global system, that you have to make Russia work effectively within the international financial and trading system, that it has to adapt its own internal rules and its own structures so that it will be competitive in doing so. This is sort of the Kudrins of the world and the people that we have thought of as economic reformers. We'll see if they manage their way through this crisis. If they do, my suspicion is they will come out stronger than they went in relative to others. If they do not, and if the collapse really turns into something in which the authorities seemingly are less capable of managing the system than is necessary, then I think that there is a prospect that the opposite group will have its hands strengthened. And I think it's in that that we have every hope that we will see them succeed in managing their way through with the current people in the monetary and financial world. So I want to stop there and open it up to the audience. I think these are two extraordinarily important and comprehensive views that really deserve to be at the bottom of any analysis we are doing about Russia, its place in the world, and how it's going to develop in the future. So I turn it over to the audience.
That's what I was waiting for. I'm Helen Raphael, Resources for the Future. But I'd like to pick up on your mention of the vertical structure from the center to the regions and so forth, because yesterday at Brookings Institution, Strobe Talbot said that he expects that within the next foreseeable future, Russia would break up under the strain of the difference in the effect of this crisis in different regions and different levels of the vertical structure. I wonder if you could be more detailed about what that might involve And you were saying you hope and expect that the recovery would come and it wouldn't collapse. But I'm wondering in what way it might collapse if that should come about.
Well, I'm no expert on the breakup of countries, although I come from the former Yugoslavia. One, I think, would have to think hard about the mechanics of breakups of any country. In advance, and even so, it's very, very difficult to predict things. I certainly haven't predicted the collapse of my own country on the eve of that happening, and perhaps I was just too close to this particular episode. But I think that when you look at the, and this is just my own personal, a little more than a layman's opinion on this complex issue, is that you usually need very powerful internal and external forces conspiring together for breakups of countries, and they tend to be associated with the rise of nationalisms powered by specific power structures within the countries, as well as significant internal economic and social crisis, as well as the external factors. I think you have to put all of this together. It's hard for me to see, those kinds of factors conspiring in this environment on Russia. Having said that, I think internally, when I talk about the economy, which is more my terrain, I certainly see that the social impact that we described at the aggregate level certainly has an important regional dimension. In fact, we already know that the regional impact is spreading very rapidly, and that broadly we have regions with three types of characteristics being hit most, which gives us some clue about the social tensions and the resulting social impact in the regional arena. One is the obvious monocities, right? The cities that rely on a single source of employment and company towns that are hardest hit. The second are the regions with already very high level of unemployment and poverty that are already socially vulnerable. So their relatively modest additional increases, could spark the plug of social tensions easier than in other areas. And then you have the third element, which is associated with the sectoral structure of this crisis. We already know that certain sectors are harder affected, harder hit than others. Manufacturing, auto industry, construction, now trade as well, retail trade. And this particular sectoral structure also means that even some regions that are comparatively considered relatively well-to-do, like Moscow, St. Petersburg, for example, large agglomerations of people and activity, will be actually hit hard, and are hit hard because simply because of the particular economic structure that is now shedding labor at a very rapid rate. So I think clearly the social impact is significant in the aggregate, in the regions. And that's precisely why I think there is a case. There is both a kind of a human and macroeconomic policy case to try to cushion that impact. Russia also has a certain amount of resources to deal with this problem this year and even next year. Russia as a country is also creditworthy. Its public debt is very, very low. It can borrow externally. It has some more levers than many other countries. Including Eastern European countries, to weather the crisis if it lasts only about a year or a year and a half and so on and so forth. Clearly, nobody can guarantee that, however. So I think the big question is really not whether the centrifugal forces are going to get out of control. I think it's really more how the social impact is going to play out in the regional arena and what can the policy do in this environment to cushion that impact.
Hi, thanks. I'm Diana Galperin from the Carnegie Endowment. I have two questions. I think yesterday a senior policy official from Russia came out saying that inflation is likely to be one of the biggest problems for Russia in the near future. And I was wondering if you could talk about, with the current limited financial position of the Russian government, what its options are for dealing with this inflation and what effects this would have. And also, I was wondering if you could talk about the condition of the banks in Russia right now. As I understand it, there hasn't been a run on banks yet. Is this in the foreseeable future? And what steps is the government currently taking to make sure that the banks hold up? Thank you.
Inflation. Before the crisis, it was clearly a big problem in the context of an overheating economy, and where it made a lot of sense to cool off the economy, bring the inflation down, bring the interest rates down, and essentially bring the economy from an overheating to a more kind of a sustainable pace, sustainable equilibrium that would be less susceptible to a hard landing, as they say. Meanwhile, the largest crisis after the Second World War intervened and brought about that hard landing beyond what was expected. And so much so that basically what has happened, all of the drivers of inflation in Russia just about 4 or 5 months ago started working in the opposite direction, in reverse. So massive capital inflows, which were seeping into the domestic liquidity in the context of quasi-fixed exchange rate, the credit boom, import prices, inflation. All of these factors are now basically working in reverse. And moreover, the wide output gap, the gap between the potential and the actual output, that's open, is and the depressed consumption and internal demand makes for a very, very kind of a depressed conditions where it's very, very difficult to see how inflation is going to be a big problem in the short term, even with the large fiscal expansion that we see taking place right now. Just like in the United States, the banks in Russia are not lending in this environment, and they may not have ability to lend for a while. So the only source of liquidity is very much the government. The fiscal policy is trying to kind of fill that void of liquidity, that big sucking sound from external and domestic financial system. And this is not enough. This deficit of 7-8% of GDP, as big as it is, it's not enough to cause a big inflation beyond what we've seen, I think, last year. So my expectation is that inflation at best is going to stay more or less in the same levels of 11-13%, could be even lower if the output gap continues opening up. So I wouldn't say that this is the biggest problem right now. I think the biggest problem is the real economy and the social impact, and that's so first things first. The second, but clearly it's something to deal with in the next stage. The bank, state of the banking sector and the bank consolidation, I think, as I said, a lot of support was extended and the patient was stabilized. Guess what? Compared to the United States and a lot of other Western countries, no major banks failed in Russia. There were no systemic banks that failed, contrary to expectations back in October and November. So one could argue that first big point of impact went fairly well. The problem is that there is a second tsunami of gradually building large non-performing loans across the banking system, including the systemic banks. That's been voiced already by the Ministry of Finance, by the chairman of the Sberbank. And so the question arises, how is this going to be handled? And I think that there is no way around accelerating banking sector consolidation in Russia. How is that going to actually take place in reality? It's probably going to be a combination of government stepping in, providing support to some of the systemic banks, and also maybe some private takeovers, as well as the outright failures of some of the smaller banks and the medium-sized banks that will have no other options except to exit the essentially an overpopulated and overly optimistic banking system.
Yes. Uh, Ирина Акимушкина, Business People Magazine. I have two questions. First one, you mentioned programs who will support poor people. And in this context, I would like to ask you, do you think cash transfers could be effective in this way, how it works in some developing countries? And the second question is about agriculture. Taking into account big high dependence of Russia on food import, do you expect some improvements in agriculture production in Russia, and or if it will be like subsistence agriculture, I would say vegetable plot subsistence agriculture, as it was in when the Soviet Union collapsed in the first years, especially.
I think there is a lot that can be done to improve the social safety net in Russia. As I mentioned earlier, it's a fairly vast and inefficient social safety net that doesn't really focus very much on the poor, those that need it most. There are such elements like housing allowances, housing subsidies that we know already about 40% of which are benefiting really the top deciles of the population. So clearly there's a lot of fat there. That could be cut or redistributed to better uses. And the problem is that better instruments, the kind of income-based, tested-based instruments, will take time to develop in Russia. And meanwhile, you know, you have to work with what we have. So it's really, you know, what we propose here is really kind of an emergency program while you try to reform the existing social safety net. So that's a kind of a long and but it's clearly there are lessons out there. You know, there's Mexico programs, you know, for example, that could be replicated. But that's going to take time. Meanwhile, you have to kind of try to do what you can. On the agriculture side, I think there's two effects to keep in mind. The first is the what we see in a crisis in any country. There is a return to basic agriculture. Agriculture is a safe, if low, source of subsistence to people who lose other sources of income, employment, and that is happening. And that is that. So agriculture is a bit of a cushion, also. On the other hand, Russia's agriculture also leaves a lot to be desired in terms of the competitiveness and links with the rest of the economy and building the value-added base of agro-processing industries that we see in a lot of Western developed market economies, and I think that crisis provides some opportunity for that kind of agriculture more competitive to grow. But again, that's going to have to grow out of something, and that something is likely to be again a part of this structural reform agenda. You know, the greater entrenchment of the property rights, of the land titling, of the freer market for land and for property and security of property and collaterals, all of these intangibles that are very, very important for the proper functioning of a market economy. And even if it is functioning seemingly, we see that it hits snags. So I think it's an opportunity for sure. But in the short term, I think agriculture provides some cushion. There is one category of people who are involved in agriculture that has been hard hit, and those are the Central Asian migrants, because they were among the first, obviously, who taken the hit in agriculture, in construction, in low menial jobs. There's essentially a massive loss of income to Tajikistan, to Central Asia, to Moldova, and that's a separate kind of a social element of the story itself. Many of these people are returning, but some are actually staying and hunkering down and trying to see what you know, how long is this going to last. But again, the longer it lasts, the longer the social impact, both in Russia and in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Marina Mateski, Alpha Press Group. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the human capital development in Russia, if the government is doing anything, whether the current crisis will affect greatly human capital development. What is the overall level of professionalism in state and private sectors? Thank you.
A huge topic, obviously, and many different dimensions of human capital development. I would just kind of mention en passant that some of the basic indicators of human capital development suggest that Russia, and this is no surprise to anybody who has followed Russia, look better than that of many countries. But some look pretty bad. For example, the male life expectancy is only about 59-60 in a middle-income country, and this is associated, obviously, with the very high incidence of alcoholism and related traffic accidents and coronary diseases that are related to the lifestyle effects. And so there's a lot that can be done to address some of these, if you like, worst elements, worst consequences of human capital problems in Russia, especially on the health front. Education is, as we know, has a lot of good features to it, and you know, especially in sciences, in engineering, and so on and so forth. And some of the indicators there are actually much better and much more promising. But even so, when you dig below the surface and try to get a sense of the quality, then you quickly realize that there are also lacuna there in terms of the quality and the applicability, if you like, of education to the new and emerging market economy and you know, the demands of quickly growing domestic and international businesses. So it's a very long and convoluted answer, but it's a very, very complex picture, where on the one hand you have a very highly educated population, but population that is only now catching up with the kind of a very rapidly transforming world economy in terms of the skills and applicability and the entrepreneurial spirits needed in that kind of much more competitive and rapidly shifting environment. At the same time, the population that is, in terms of the health status, in a very vulnerable position because of a number of these long-standing problems, including, as I said, the health status of males in Russia, but also extending probably to children and specific categories of, such as I mentioned, families with large number of children, unemployed, low-end pensioners, and so on and so forth. So when we talk about human capital development, we really have to unpack this thing and kind of talk specifically about, you know, elements of it, health, education, social protection, and so on and so forth.
No, excuse me, Jessica Matthews at Carnegie. I wondered if all three of you could give briefly your sense of what the appetite is in the government to make the kind of reforms, including WTO, which has been hanging around now for seemingly forever. It's one thing to say a crisis provides an opportunity, which sort of theoretically is true, but politically... what do you see out there as really the willingness to tackle these when the floor is kind of falling out from under?
Well, my quick take is that the crisis does provide an opportunity, and high oil prices certainly don't. So, you know, this is probably as good as any time to put back some of this reform agenda back on track. I would add that part of the equation is the United States-Russia relationship. And I think to the extent also that there is a new, witnessing a new rapprochement between the two countries, I think that's going to provide a much more favorable, broader context in which some of these processes, including WTO, may take place. I worry more about the much broader and a global backlash of protectionism, you know, of which Russia is just a small part. You know, if the world begins to sink back into the kind of protectionism that we've seen on the eve of these kinds of events, then I think it's going to be, WTO itself as an institution and as an agenda globally will be under threat. I think one of the good things that came out of the G20 meetings is that WTO is now given that a specific new mandate to actually monitor this problem of protectionism world around and see what can be done about it. So I think Russia is really a part of a much bigger equation now. But I feel that very much like Ambassador Collins that the crisis in Russia does provide opportunity for reformers in the country to gain an upper hand and to push through some of these remaining reforms that have stalled. And there is another element to it that is sometimes forgotten. There is a whole new generation of people, educated, exposed to the West, living partly in the West, coming back, having stake in the integration of Russia into the world economy, people who have no or very little recollection of ties to the Soviet Union. It's already 20 years since the collapse of the empire. These are the people who will be leading Russia in the very near future. And, I've been meeting a lot of them in various agencies. I've been very much impressed with many of them, and I don't think that Russia's reforms really depend so much on Mr. Kudrin as sometimes portrayed here in the West. There is a whole slew of young, capable people behind him coming to the fore and will be able, I think, to carry the torch when needed.
Point I make is, I was in Russia immediately after China, and I must say I was struck by what I felt was a huge engagement.
Okay. I was struck by what I felt was a huge engagement and awareness of the international context and the issues and the problems. On the part of the Chinese, and less impressed by what I heard and felt when I was in Russia, and I don't know why that is. I was quite struck by the fact that I found it difficult to find English. I'm not saying it's not possible to find English language newspapers, but you really have to work at it to buy an English language newspaper, including at the airport. In terms of WTO, which I know a little more about, I think that, of course, Russia is the only G20 member that is not a WTO member, and I have to remark on the fact that immediately after the November meeting, when we all declared that we weren't going to raise new barriers, immediately afterwards Russia raised tariffs on a number of items, which of course they can do legally since they're not a WTO member, right? That's one of the few advantages you have. And from talking to economists in Russia while I was there, I got a sense that this was really not a priority of the government at the moment. I'm not at all surprised because I don't think big-scale trade reforms, whether in the Doha context or in a regional context, not to mention unilaterally, are particularly high on people's agendas at the moment because everybody is in a very, very defensive sort of mode. The general sense I had was one of a big shock that had hit a country that thought it was doing just great, and that everybody, and that includes policymakers, is still adapting to the new and much tougher reality. And I think that process of moving from denial to acceptance is a very necessary process before you start undertaking the really tough reforms. And my sense is that in China, they've moved much faster than in Russia in that sense.
Well, I guess I'll take the last word. Having an opportunity doesn't mean you use it. And I have a very uncomfortable feeling that if you were to take the temperature today in Russia, the prevailing mood probably is the one that I used to find really the dominant policy, which is muddle through. That in essence, yes, this is a terrible thing the Americans have done to us. And all these things are awful. And, you know, these statistics that everybody uses are pretty bad. But, you know, we saved a lot of money. We have some reserves. And the real interest is to get through this. And if it isn't going to last beyond, let's say, another 10 months or so, we can probably make it. The problem with that mentality is that it's not the kind that prepares you to say, oh, we really have to make some big, serious changes. It is the adaptive sort of, I won't say hunker down, but you know, make the right decision today to get to tomorrow, and we'll see what tomorrow brings, because it certainly was not what we expected yesterday. And I don't think probably we are yet at the point where those who would like to see some really quite aggressive moves in new directions are yet in a position to make that happen. I think it's very risk averse, and that there's probably a sense that the biggest risk right now is doing all sorts of things that would be experimental from their point of view. So, you know, muddling your way through the status quo, if you can pull it off, is probably the preferred option. And that isn't one which will give great comfort to reformers or those who hope to see Russia embark on, you know, sort of important new directions. Now, and so I'm not here to suggest that just because there is an opportunity, we're going to see it exploited to the full, and so we won't. But look, we're not going to see it here either, probably, or in any country. Everybody's going to try to get through this as best possible and maybe make some serious changes as the process unfolds. What I think is the great unknown, and I do think we're seeing people beginning to worry that maybe it isn't just something you are going to be able to muddle through very easily. That is, there are going to have to be some serious thoughts about how you, let's say, ensure that the system is flexible enough to keep people on board. And my sense is that it's very interesting to me that Medvedev over the last few weeks has somehow found it important, and whether it's himself or his team or all of them with Putin and everybody else, that they have decided they have to sort of engage the population more broadly than they have before. That suggests they're worried that too rigid a sort of effort to run it from the top and, you know, just hunker down may not be enough, that they need to begin to sort of talk more broadly to people. I don't know where that's leading, and I don't think anyone does, but it is a different direction from the way you saw them being, saw them treating, the need to communicate with the public over the past several years. So we'll see what it means. For the moment, though, I would not expect major moves to structural reform or whatever. I think it's going to take time for them to decide to move in that direction if they do. So I want to thank the panel. And thank you all for coming. And I look forward to further reports and updates from Jellicoe and Uri. Thank you.